I'm Femi Oke. Thanks for watching the stream. If you take a look at my laptop, we can see how it all started. The very first tweet ever by @Jack on March 21st, 2006. Fast forward to October the 27th of this year, and that is when Twitter got a brand new owner. So on today's episode of the stream, we are asking, how will Twitter thrive under Elon Musk? This is a conversation you are very much part of, whether you're on Twitter or if you're on YouTube. I do realise the irony of asking you about Twitter while you're on YouTube, but the comment section is right here. Be part of today's show. We have a panel of fabulous experts. Hello, Vittoria and Gillian and Meredith. So good to have all three of you here in the conversation. Vittoria, please say hello to our international audience. Tell them who you are and what you do.
I'm Vittoria Elliott, and I'm the Platforms and Power Reporter with Wired.
Good to have you. Hello, Gillian. Say hello to our audience around the world. Tell them who you are and what you do.
Hi, I'm the Director for International Freedom of Expression at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a digital rights organization.
All right, great to have you, Gillian. And Meredith, welcome to the stream. Please introduce yourself to our audience around the world.
Thank you for having me. My name is Meredith Clark. I'm an associate professor in journalism and communication studies at Northeastern University in Boston.
All right, ladies, I had a look to see when you all joined Twitter. Vittoria, June 2012, thank you for your service. Meredith, oh my goodness, 2009, extraordinary. You've been there for a long time. Gillian, you're virtually an OG. You joined in February of 2008. I'm going to take some of our viewers back to the very beginning with a little timeline that takes us back to 2006. Do you remember that first tweet that I showed you? Well, in 2006, Twitter launched as a micro-blogging site. And then in the past 16 years, there have been now an audience of 240 million active users around the world. Average number of tweets in any one day, 500 million tweets sent in a day. Gillian, you're almost an OG. Tell us what you've noticed that's been different since, say, the end of October. Are you getting a sense of something different, or is it just anxiety?
I think I'll be honest and say a lot of it is anxiety. Mm-hmm. There have been small changes so far. There's definitely been an emboldening of the right and of people, you know, making racist comments and harassing others on the platform. But in terms of concrete changes internally, we've seen staff laid off, but we haven't seen any changes to policies or to content moderation practices just yet. I feel that we're on the verge of them, though. So I do want to say that.
Meredith, too soon?
Yeah, I think so. I think I find that interesting because I think it all depends on who you are. The experience that some folks are having, particularly people from structurally marginalized backgrounds, women of color, people of color, LGBTQIA folks, they're having a markedly different experience. And while we may say that it's anecdotal at this point, they are reporting an uptick in harassment and hateful speech.
I'm just looking at Edgar here on Twitter. Edgar is from Uganda, and he starts his tweet with, "Ah, it's very much uncertain future, truth to be told." He's here on my laptop, here on my laptop. So he does not know, and I think that mirrors so many other Twitter users right now. Vittoria, what can you tell us concrete that has definitely changed in the last few days?
Well, again, I think obviously it depends on the community you're a part of. And, you know, it, structurally inside the organization, we know that they don't have nearly as many people who are working on their content policy staff right now. And one of the things that I have heard from people who are outside researchers who are sometimes in contact with platforms when they find issues, disinformation networks, important, you know, narratives that are spreading, is that they don't know who to contact anymore about problematic stuff that's staying up on the platform. And a really great example of this is Brazil, which just had an election and has really been marred by disinformation around that election, that a researcher I spoke to mentioned that tweets that they might otherwise expect to have been removed, or at least would have contacted Twitter's team about, they don't know who to contact, and those things have stayed up.
Meredith, if you're nodding, you're saying yes, just articulate that nod. Go ahead.
Well, the things that I'm thinking about are the misinformation and disinformation networks that are not only in Brazil and other countries throughout the world. You know, my focus is mostly here on the United States. And we're seeing those same things pop up, but perhaps not in the same way, not in the political arena. And those networks have been able to pretty much proceed unimpeded because they're not as prominent when it comes to some of the bigger topics. So the election in Brazil, or particularly the election in, say, Georgia, where folks are still engaging in the bad faith actions that they were taking before, but because it's not seen as important or as prevalent, they're just not getting the same sort of attention.
It's interesting that on YouTube, our audiences are talking about what's happening right now. Gillian, one viewer saying, I'm confused that will Twitter still be safe or will it not be safe? I think there were always elements of Twitter that were very edgy and not safe at all, depending on what community you belong to. But that safety aspect, Gillian, what are you expecting to be different?
Yeah, so I mean, as Meredith said, Twitter was already not safe for a lot of people, and I think it is getting worse. But I think that, you know, some of the things to look at going forward, the new verification scheme is absolutely something that concerns me, not just because, you know, some of us will have to pay $8, but there are going to be a lot of people whose tweets are now not going to make it into the feeds, and who for whom verification provided a set of protections. Twitter also getting rid of its human rights team. That team did a lot of work ensuring that Twitter adhered to the UN business and human rights principles. That team's gone now in its entirety. And so I think a lot of the concerns are for people in conflict zones and in places where that team had been doing the most work thus far.
So Shannon here tweets just recently, this is November the 4th, have a look here on my laptop. Yesterday was my last day at Twitter. The entire human rights team has been cut from the company. I am enormously proud of the work we did to implement the UN guiding principles on business and human rights to protect those at risk in global conflicts and crises, including Ethiopia. Victoria, what are you hearing from inside Twitter? What are you seeing from those staff members who've been cut and axed and doing jobs that you don't always associate with a social media company, but were definitely happening at Twitter?
Well, I think there was a big Twitter Spaces for a lot of the people that were laid off last week. And I think the biggest takeaway that you can hear from all the people who were let go is that they were incredibly proud of the work that they were able to do at Twitter, and that the culture was something that really supported that, whether that's their Meta team, which is their ethical AI team. You know, that was something that didn't exist at any other company. No sort of big for-profit social media company was going to invest in studying bias and AI on their platform in the same way that Twitter was. So I think there was something really unique about the willingness of the company to engage with sort of these thornier questions about the role of their platform in modern society and the ethical implications of the work they were doing. And those people are the people who have, by and large, been cut from the new version of Twitter.
Sure. I think one of the biggest ideas that Elon Musk has been sharing, and not just recently, but over a long period of time when he's been a Twitter user, is the idea of free speech, and Twitter should be a place where free speech can happen. Gillian, you start with what those challenges are, and then Meredith, you pick up about the realities. Gillian, you start.
Sure. So, you know, I've been looking at Twitter's role as the public square, so to speak, for many years. And Twitter started off as a platform that, you know, called itself the free speech wing of the Free Speech Party back in 2012. And then over the years, recognized the role that it played with respect to, you know, curbing harassment, fighting terrorism, and all sorts of other things, including disinformation, which has been brought up a few times. So I think that now, you know, what Elon Musk is trying to do isn't necessarily the same version of free speech that the UN would put out. He's not looking to align it better with international human rights frameworks. He's looking to amplify certain voices. Yes, he's talked about getting rid of bots and spam, but ultimately, I think that by failing to fight disinformation, failing to fight some of our other societal ills, and then also at the same time saying he wants to adhere to the laws of the land in every country in which they operate. Well, what does that mean for users in Saudi Arabia, for example?
Meredith.
Yeah, I don't see that working very well for Elon Musk. And in fact, I sort of characterize the way he talks about free speech as really being akin to opening up chaos. I think it provides a civics lesson for all of us. You know, here, particularly in the US, where Twitter was founded, free speech has to do with the government's inability to intervene in something that someone says or something that they post, unless it is directly harmful or hateful, if it's one of those prohibited forms of speech. What Elon Musk is talking about is giving free rein to people who have disproportionate areas of power, disproportionate reaches of power, to say what they want to. And he hosts this on the platform that belongs to a private company, where folks can say whatever they want and they can rest assured that the private company isn't going to weigh in on that. That's very different than keeping the government from intervening and saying you can or cannot express yourself, you can or cannot petition your government for redress of grievances. It's quite different for someone to be able to say whatever wild and outlandish or even false thing that they want to say versus someone perhaps engaging in important political speech that speaks truth to power.
Victoria, there was some engagement that I spotted a few days ago which made me smile. Let me show you the tweet. It's right here on my laptop. So Elon Musk tweeted out, "The bird is free." And then from Europe, we have, "In Europe, the bird will fly by our EU rules." And this is the Digital Strategy Act, I believe. I'll just double check that. But it's basically laws that in Europe make sure that what is happening online is in line with what would happen offline as well. There are rules, there are regulations. Victoria, do you feel that maybe Elon Musk and what's happening at Twitter right now is in a little bubble and they're not seeing the whole world of Twitter, just the little bit of Twitter that they see?
I definitely think that, you know, before he was the owner of Twitter, Elon was a super user of the platform, and he definitely thinks about the platform in that way, that this is a place where one would come to broadcast their message and they wouldn't necessarily want to be censored. But most Twitter users are not like that. A lot of people lurk and get information. They're not necessarily heavy content creators, as we might call them, on another platform. And I think it's also really important to note, in a global sense, that Twitter's conception of free speech is often much broader than a lot of the countries that it operates in. And that can be problematic, as we see in the US, but it also can be incredibly important. For instance, in India, Twitter has actually filed a suit in the Karnataka court to protect the free speech of its users to resist government orders to take down tweets and accounts that the BJP government has said are a threat to Indian security and sovereignty. And, you know, similarly, its protection of anonymity in countries like Saudi has allowed dissidents, people from marginalized communities, to have a voice in a way that they might not otherwise be able to have through traditional media. And so it's what is particularly interesting is that Musk has this very sort of Americanized view of free speech, where in our country, it's sort of like anything that is not illegal can stay on the platform. But the reality is that what's legal varies from place to place. And in many places, you know, what free speech means for Twitter is actually been really helpful for journalists and for activists. And if you're going to abide by the laws of the land in those places, those are voices you're also going to silence. And that seems very at odds in terms of his commitment to free speech that he's been very vocal about.
I mentioned DS.
I would add really quickly.
Meredith, go ahead and then Jane.
It's not just, you know, an American idea of free speech, but it's a partisan idea of free speech. Elon Musk seems to be very much aligned with folks that are more right wing here in the United States. And that concerns me, frankly. Might he adapt the same sort of positions in, say, Brazil or in India, where we have seen tendencies for governments to persecute smaller minority people.
Does it matter if one person, although he has a huge following on Twitter and he owns Twitter, has those views? Because Twitter is more than one person, isn't it?
Are we not hyper-focused? Much more than one person.
Yeah, I mean, Twitter is the rest of us. It's not actually one person. Maybe we're getting this out of proportion. Maddie, go ahead.
No. His reach and his power is what is disproportionate. We're talking about a billionaire who had the ability to borrow, let's be clear, enough money to buy this platform that is networked among a number of journalistic systems. I think that's one of the things that we tend to downplay, that we pay attention to the individuals on the platform, but not the connections that the individuals are a part of. Now at the helm of Twitter, Elon Musk is at the center of a lot of journalism and where journalists look for information, where they connect with sources, and where they publicize that information. And having him in there and not abiding by any sort of rules or conventions that we are used to or that we can even predict. This is someone who has been so unpredictable as to say that he would cut off the internet access to Ukraine that he was providing for free.
But the online community pushed back and then he changed his mind. So that is the power of the masses as opposed to the individual. So there's going to be a conversation that's going to go backwards and forwards. It's going to be drama filled, but it will be a conversation. Let me just say, Gillian, before I come to you, that DSA is Digital Services Act, which is very important if you're in Europe and you're online. Gillian, go ahead. I'm going to ask you to make it brief because I also want to get to the idea of how does Twitter make money? Is that even possible? Gillian, you go first.
Sure, yeah, happy to make it brief. I mean, yeah, I just want to go back to something that was said about free speech, because it's true, of course, that Twitter is a private company, it can do what it wants, but we're looking at a moment where press freedom is backsliding all over the world. And what Twitter has done for so many users, including a lot of the activists that I work with, has provided a platform where they don't have another platform within their country. And so, yes, I mean, I think we got, you know, free speech and the First Amendment kind of confused a little while ago in that free speech does, for me, it is something that, you know, exists on these platforms too, especially when there are not other spaces for speech.
So let's talk about making money and if that is even possible for a social media site like Twitter. So Steve is watching right now from the UK. I'm still staying with Twitter, he says, but I will never pay for it. Ah! Oh no, Victoria, is that bad news? If people just say, I'm not paying for this, why should I?
Well, I think, you know, that is something that Musk is currently trying to figure out. He just hosted a Twitter Spaces, which was open, but specifically geared towards advertisers, where, you know, he said, I think if people have to pay $8 a month or if there's sort of a price of admission, that perhaps people won't be as mean to each other, won't be as aggressive, there won't be as much, so much hate speech. So, you know, I think there's right now there's a scramble to try and find ways to make money, particularly because advertisers have been so concerned, and this goes back to sort of his vision of free speech, have been so concerned about the type of content that their ads may run next to. Right. And so for Twitter generally, there were, even before Musk took over, there were some criticisms about it not innovating enough to make money. Obviously, it bought Vine, and Vine was a very popular video sharing platform, and that died. So, you know, there have been sort of previous criticisms of the company not taking opportunities to build out other revenue streams. And realistically, a lot of other platforms, they look to content creators like Instagram or TikTok influencers as a way to sort of bring money onto the platform. So I think those will also be on the table as well. And at least what it seems like right now is that $8 a month may not be for everybody, but he has floated a sort of suggestion of a soft paywalled platform where maybe everyone has to pay to get in. We don't know yet. And he does, if nothing else, seem to be responsive, as you mentioned earlier, to pushback from users or from particularly vocal people.
And deletes tweets.
We also don't know who's talking to him behind the scenes.
Yes. You were actually on a Twitter Spaces just before we got onto the air, and Elon Musk was in that Twitter space. What, did he say anything that was newsworthy, do you think?
I think, again, it's mostly about quelling advertiser concerns at this point.
Okay.
And, you know, one of the things he said was, you know, if you have to attach a phone number and a credit card to every account, it'll be much harder for trolls and misinformation, disinformation campaigns to operate on the platform. But, you know, many of these people are very smart operators. They can find ways around these things, credit card numbers that are stolen.
I don't know what you mean, Victoria. What could you possibly be talking about? All right, I was on Twitter at the weekend, and something really made me feel good about the communities that I'm part of. And the hashtag was just Black Twitter. And I was lost for about 6 hours because I went down that rabbit hole and didn't come out again. But what was beautiful about this, and it's the same for science Twitter, people with disabilities Twitter, and LGBTQIA plus Twitter, is that the communities have power and buoy each other up, support each other, tell stories, share knowledge. And I was so encouraged, Meredith, because what people were saying is that we created a lot of this content that is fantastic and exciting. And the reason people come here is because of what we do in this space. We're not going anywhere. We are sticking around. What do you make of that?
I mean, I expect for users who consider themselves part of Black Twitter to stay for a number of reasons. They're saying they're not going to something like Mastodon because they will be siloed essentially into the different servers that Mastodon uses to sort its users. One of the things that troubles me about the resilience that Black Twitter has is that at the same time of recognizing that we do contribute so much to the platform, there's a lot that's also extracted from Black Twitter, and there is no credit, there is no capital, there is no sort of recognition for how much value Black people, Black communities, and Black culture have poured into this platform. And frankly, with an owner like Elon Musk, someone whose companies have come under scrutiny for the kind of culture, the hostile culture that they've created around Black workers, I have deep concerns about what that means for Black users who decide to remain on the platform.
I want to actually bring in a voice that takes us into a global perspective for what Twitter does beyond the United States. And this is Odanga, who spoke to us a little bit earlier. Have a listen, have a look.
One of the things that we have actually found is that the platform lends itself too easily to allowing malicious actors to seed narratives into it through the use of its trending section. And it's something that they have completely been unable to try and tame, especially over the past 2 years in many countries across Africa. Secondly, the platform is full of widespread harassments, not only of journalists and activists, but even celebrities. Just think about the number of celebrities that usually end up saying that, look, I'm quitting this platform, I'm done with the toxicity of this thing, and I'm not going to do it anymore. And I worry that with the direction that it's going, you know, with it going private and with the huge layoffs on content moderation and trust and safety teams, that these things are eventually going to get worse. The avenues for accountability for the platform are actually shrinking, and that is something that should worry us.
All right. Yes, we have so many questions for our YouTube audience, so this is going to be the speed round. You have less than 30 seconds to answer all of these questions. Victoria, I'm volunteering you first of all. Why did Elon Musk dismiss so many workers? What are your thoughts about that? Very briefly.
Well, he has always been publicly critical of the content moderation, trust and safety teams. And so I think those layoffs seemed somewhat inevitable. And also he's trying to make Twitter profitable. He, you know, took a significant financial hit to buy the platform. And I think the layoffs are also a way of trying to figure out how to keep him from losing money on this venture.
All right, Victoria, let me get in another quick question. I'm going to put this one to you. This one comes from Stephen, who says Al Jazeera is a leftist cesspool. Thank you for the compliment. All right, YouTube compliments. Thank you. Content moderation and hate speech is the same as before on Twitter. Musk is simply allowing free speech as guaranteed by the US Constitution. Meredith. Briefly.
Fundamental misunderstanding of what free speech means. But a company cannot promote the freedoms that are ensconced in the First Amendment. Those freedoms are upheld by our government. What we're looking at when we talk about First Amendment freedoms and the right to free speech is the right to keep the government from interfering in what you have to say. If Elon Musk decides tomorrow that someone with an opinion on the platform should go, they will. Just ask Kathy Griffin.
All right. So Victoria joined in 2012. Jillian joined in 2008. Meredith joined in April 2009. Yes. Are any of you leaving anytime soon?
No, I'm with Black Twitter. I'll be here until it's time to turn the lights off.
Victoria.
I'm not leaving, but I'll probably also have a Mastodon account.
Oh, and Jillian.
I'm splitting my time, but I'm staying on Twitter because so many of the international activists that I follow are still using it to get attention.
Thank you, guests. Thank you, YouTube. I'll see you next time. Take care.